people have seen. Well, these people, Campanile, Lustos, Lapshwar, and Merritt, I think were the first to put spinning black holes in this kind of an orbital configuration. And what they found is when you set them in orbit going around each other, the entire orbital plane goes up and down in phase with the bobbing. So the black holes are going up, and they're going down, and they're going up, and they're going down. And as they get into the, as they in spiral, get going faster and faster and faster, and finally merge, you get a kick. The combined black hole goes flying off at a speed that's an order of magnitude higher than any other kicks that had been observed, up to 4,000 kilometers per second, as I believe found by the second people I've listed there. And of course, if you're an astrophysicist, you'd think, oh my gosh, that's, you know, higher than the escape velocity of any galaxy I've ever contemplated. So, what do I do for my structure formation simulations? I've got to change my semi-analytic model. I've got to figure out, you know, what this means for predicting black holes and central galaxies and all that. So astrophysicists go and do that, and that's interesting, but that's not what I'm talking about today. I'm talking about a question that you may be wondering, which is, what the hell is going on? How can these two bodies bob up and down when there's just sort of, you know, you think a central force, gravity? So what is this weird effect, and does it have anything to do with these enormous kicks? So what you might think, what I certainly thought the first time I heard this, and you can still hear people say this, is that, okay, bobbing, it's some weird GR effect. There's frame dragging. You know, frame dragging is this property of the Kerr metric that if you have no angular momentum at infinity, when you fall in, you actually end up going around the black hole. You're kind of dragged into motion. So maybe, you know, the one black hole is frame dragging the other black hole, and the directions sort of work out. So maybe that's what's causing the bobbing. But anyway, it's not too much to worry about because the gravitational field carries momentum. So there's no violation of momentum conservation. It just means when the bodies are moving up, there must be some momentum in the gravitational field pointing downwards, and there's some sloshing back and forth between the bodies and the gravitational field, and that accounts for bobbing.
So when you say there's bobbing up and down, what you actually drew was something like that. So it looks as though it was just simply a finite inclination, but you're actually talking about the whole plane.
Yeah, I should make that clear.
Going up and
that's
down.
Right, yeah. Yeah. In fact, early on when we were looking at this effect, we thought we were seeing bobbing effects, but we were just doing one body, and it was just our body was inclined relative to the coordinate system we were seeing. But in this case, we have two bodies, and they're really going up and down together. So if you went into the rest, you know, frame, they'd be going like this.
Right.
It's very bizarre.
Well, you might say, well, did you get your coordinates right?
Well, that's...
The coordinates, right?
Yeah, so you're looking at, in black hole simulations, you're looking at some punctures or something like that. And yeah, it could have been a coordinate effect, I suppose. So at some level, this work will, I think the next point here will clarify where I'm going, and then you'll see to what extent that addresses your question. So this picture is in some sense what you would naturally believe, but I'm going to argue today, and in some cases I think actually demonstrate, prove in some sense that it's actually wrong. So first of all, this bobbing thing is totally normal. If we went over to the pool table where the cosmology group meeting was today and we got some billiard balls and we drilled holes in them and attached a string to their centers of mass and set them spinning like this and took them to the International Space Station and put them in orbit, they would bob up and down. It would be very small. But when you push them in orbit without pushing them up, there'd be some tiny bobbing up and down effect. And I'm going to show you that today. It's a weird kinematical effect that has to do with what you think the center of mass of the body should be doing and what the center of mass really does. And second, which is really a combination of showing and arguing, is that, yeah, there is some kind of momentum exchange going on, but at least in an electromagnetic analogy that I'm going to consider, it doesn't cause bobbing because there's some really interesting phenomena here called hidden momentum. Which
it's in the pool ball example, and it's a Newtonian effect.
It is in fact in the slow motion limit of relativistic kinematics, but it does require some things you would call relativistic effects. I will explain it. Half of the talk is really doing that. Hidden momentum is another weird thing I can't explain yet. I just want to tell you where I'm going. And so finally, I'm going to argue that based on all this, first of all, it's not correct to view the kick as some inertial continuation of bobbing. For example, you wouldn't get a kick in the billiard balls example because there's no momentum to radiate off and cause the kick. But I'm going to tell you why it looks like, or one explanation for why it looks like there's inertial continuation in the gravitational system, and I'll tell you what this quirk of that system is. So I think I've turned the last slide with my words into an outline, so I don't have to dwell too much here. Basically, I'm going to first tell you about this kinematical bobbing. This is the key diagram I'm going to try to get you to understand, and then I'm going to talk about an electromagnetic analog where we can make precise statements about momentum. Tell you about hidden momentum, which is in this diagram taken from Griffiths. Then I'll try to draw conclusions for gravity, and maybe I should get a pointer actually, since I'll have equations.
There is your hockey stick.
My hockey stick. Oh,
that's
awesome.
Official pointer.
Oh, this is great.
You're in Canada after all.
Yeah. So do I use the sticker?
It's up to you.
I'm going to use this end. And then finally, I'll use this picture to argue why what kicks should be like and why there's this appearance of causation. Okay, so the first thing I have to establish is center of mass. Freshman physics, it's just some weighted average of the matter density around. You divide by the total matter density, and that's the center of mass. So if you're doing relativistic mechanics, you might at first think, well, you know, T00 in some lab frame is the, you know, analog of mass. So let's do a weighted average of the stress energy making up the body. But of course, T00 is not the mass, it's the mass energy. And this type of a definition doesn't tell you much about what's going on intrinsically in the body. It's a frame-dependent thing. It tells you if I'm in some specific lab frame, how would I measure the, you know, center of lab frame energy? So that's not the right thing to be talking about. So the way to do this instead is to do something kind of implicit, which is consider a world line and look at each point. The world line defines a kind of instantaneous rest frame, which is known as the Fermi frame. It's sort of how you're boosted properly according to your local, your instantaneous velocity. And look in that rest frame and try to find a world line such that in all those rest frames, all up and down the world line, this type of an integral vanishes. So that in some hatted, you know, rest frame here, you're always mass centered. It turns out, I'm just giving you a schematic. The details are quite complicated. Dixon is the one who really figured all this out. And you can read about it there. You can read a review of it in our paper. But this is the basic idea, and I think this cartoon illustrates it very well. You've got some body moving around. And, you know, in this diagram, you try a world line that was roughly centered up here, but in the instantaneous rest frame defined by the world line, you know, up here, the body's not at all centered. So when you compute this, you know, this integral here for that body, you're going to find non-zero answer. So that means this is the wrong world line, but you find the right world line, which just hits right through the body.
Just to get this right, the rest frame is where T0i integrates is equal to zero for all i. Is that true?
The rest frame is defined by just the world line. So forget about stress energy. If I have a world line, I'm going to say the frame orthogonal to that time-like world line. So it's a local Fermi coordinate type thing. I don't know if you... locally, you can define an orthogonal hypersurface just by shooting geodesics off in the direction orthogonal to the world line. So that's what these little planes are meant to indicate. That hatted coordinate system is use those coordinates. It's usually written in more covariant language, but I mean either way. So the basic point about this, So where I was going is the right thing to talk about is the center of mass defined that way. But the lab frame center of energy is still very interesting because it appears in two really important places. So first of all, it actually appears in conservation laws, which I'll show you. And secondly, probably because of point one, that's what your intuition is tied to when you're thinking this is a strange thing. You're actually thinking of the lab frame center of energy. And what we need to use this concept understanding bobbing is this simple relationship between the lab frame center of energy and the center of mass. So I haven't derived it here. Again, it's something you use this big formalism to finally get this very simple answer. But you know, it's easy to believe this answer because of a simple physical thing. If a body is spinning and moving, there's more kinetic energy on one side than on the other side. So if your body's going like this and I'm going like this, of course you guys see the front of it moving faster. Its spin, you know, kinetic energy or whatever is adding constructively with my velocity. And of course the part closer to me is going slower. So the lab frame center of energy, when we measure it, is skewed. It's a little towards your side of the body, whereas the center of mass is, of course, right smack in the middle. And this relationship is capturing that in the slow motion limit. If you think about the directions, I've got the spin up, I've got the velocity this way,
And remember the shift I said was towards U, so that's exactly the cross product of these two vectors. So this is the key relationship, and it's almost enough to understand this kinematical bobbing effect. We need one more thing. So I'll phrase this as a kind of trivia game. We all like to talk about symmetries and conserved quantities. We all know that time translation is with energies, space translation is with momenta, rotation is angular momenta. But whenever I ask people what the conserved quantity associated with a boost is, they usually don't know. I'll give someone a chance to guess or pipe up if they do know.
Zero eigenvalue of angular momenta?
Yeah, that's right, which is, in fact, exactly, well, it's close. It's exactly this lab frame center of energy. But there's this piece minus t times momentum, because the lab frame center of energy isn't conserved. What you know about a center of energy is that it would move at a uniform velocity. So the conserved quantity, if you just write out the Killing vector, you get one term, which is exactly this lab frame center of energy type thing, and the other thing is t times the form momentum. Well, this is really minus because I have the zero down. So here's the conserved quantity, and in particular, if you go into a frame where there's no total momentum, which makes sense, there's no sense in considering your whole system translating uniformly, then the point is the lab frame center of energy is conserved, not the center of mass. So now I can explain this cartoon to you. I haven't quite shown it, but you'll find it quite reasonable that with no force in the x3 direction here, the up direction, if I just assume that, then the orbit of a body, so it's just a central force, the lab frame center of energy will be confined to a plane. That's the thing that's conserved. Okay, but the lab frame center of energy is not the center of mass. They differ exactly by v cross s. And while s doesn't change much over the orbit of a body, v does. Of course, it changes its direction. So you see that there's a shift between the lab frame and the true center of mass, which in fact exactly accounts for the bobbing. And this diagram sort of illustrates it with this physical picture that there's more lab frame kinetic energy on one side of a body than the other. So here, this is one body with a central force shown at two phases in its orbit. So out here in front, it's spinning like this, and velocity is going that way, so there's more lab frame kinetic energy down here, which means that in order for the lab frame center of mass to stay here, the lab frame center of energy to stay here, the center of mass has to move up a little bit so that you have more volume with less density of energy that you're integrating when you're performing the weighted average. And then on the other side, the situation is reversed. The spin is still in the same direction, but now the velocity is going this way, and so the bobbing is down. So that's it. I think this is, yeah.
I mean, I think that's quite a good full explanation. Is it clear that it isn't also true that it's a frame dragging effect?
So after I do this kinematic, so certainly for billiard balls, no, there's no frame dragging. But in the black hole case, you might wonder, are there other effects due to gravity? So in fact, the second part of the talk is going to be on bobbing. I'm calling this kinematical bobbing. The second portion is going to be on what I'll call dynamical bobbing.
I mean, for billiard balls, there is some frame dragging. You're saying it's too small in that case?
No, it's not. Yes, okay. I was imagining billiard balls connected by a string. So I'm just ignoring the gravitational interaction. The point is, I didn't tell you what the central force was here. All that you need here is bodies orbiting each other. And I claim there will always be this kinematic effect that makes them bob.
So it's not. It's definitely.
There's no frame dragging here.
Right.
But I haven't yet established that there's no frame dragging in a situation where you include gravity. So when we talk about the actual black hole binary, maybe there's also frame dragging forces in addition to this kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you haven't checked whether this quantitatively accounts for the bobbing in phase?
Quantitatively, well, roughly order of magnitude it does.
But it could be an order one correction.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to make quantitative predictions, but we need at least people to make the real quantitative predictions. But qualitatively,
on the frame drag, the point is that the B term there is tied to the dynamics once you put it in the binary black hole problem. And the effect would be exactly the same way. So when Franz did this calculation, he's using the numerical simulation, assuming that it was all due to frame dragging, the effect is the same, and it goes in the same direction. So they come hand in hand.
Yeah, that I think by the end of the talk, if you just let me power through.
The black hole limit, they become comparable to one another.
The qualitative direction, or the direction is the same. The size of the effect, I don't know, but it's not that they're working against each other. They do exactly the same thing.
Yeah. In this system, this is all that's going on. When I do electromagnetism and gravity, there'll be other things we have to worry about. And I'll make some points about those as well. So I had planned to redo this a little more carefully, but the time is short. So I'm just going to go through these slides quickly, just to show you that I don't have to invoke this conservation law, which I only sort of vaguely applied to the next slide. I can just say, consider a stress energy tensor that's subject to some external force density. I can then integrate the time component of this equation. That gives me this, you know, net force here is equal to the change in momentum, the usual F equals dp dt. But I could also multiply this equation by a power of x and then integrate the time component, and I get this equation, which says, so on the left here, this is some total energy, the integral of t 0, 0. It's kind of like a mass. For now, we'll pretend it is, just to give you a flavor of these equations. So this is saying mv is equal to p plus some stuff that you just get if you do this calculation. I'm going to leave it as mysterious for now. Now, if we combine these two into a single second-order equation simply by taking the time derivative here, so we have dp dt, and then plugging in dp dt is net force, then we get this equation, which looks much more like f equals ma, but we still have this mysterious stuff. But at least for this billiard ball system I've been talking about, the mysterious stuff actually vanishes. So if we, for slow motion billiard ball, so if we assume non-relativistic motion, then that means, well, so the left-hand side, E, is basically M. It would be an order V-squared effect. That's the difference. So we're going to drop those. And typically forces, you know, non-relativistic assumption is that the time component of the force is small. If it weren't small, you'd have big changes in the rest mass of the body. So this is just sort of assuming that the billiard balls somehow don't have their rest mass changed, or don't somehow have their rest mass changed by the string. It's pretty reasonable. And so that will get rid of this last term, because this is already order V, and this is also assumed small. And then we'll get rid of this term because, well, we're imagining attaching the billiard balls at the center of mass, so there's no torque. If we attach them at some other location, there might be some funny torque. But this is a, you know, center of mass assumption, and that means that, you know, this force, F0, is very peaked about exactly X equals Z, the location of the body. So at long last, we can get rid of the mysterious stuff, at least for tether balls, and we have this F equals MA. But the point is, the A here is exactly this lab frame center of energy. It's just what you get when you do the computations. And so again, the bobbing has the same explanation. Now I can actually, you know, show you that, well, the X3 direction, there's no net force. That's just from the symmetry of the system. And so for the X3 direction, you just have no acceleration of the lab frame centroid. Lab frame center of energy, but of course this relationship valid in the slow motion limit tells you again that the center of mass bobs. So if people are puzzled and want to ask again, we can do it now. Otherwise, I'll go on to the next phase of the talk. Okay. I think I'll skip the most careful approach, except just to say, you know, we modeled the stress energy of the tensor. We tried to make the assumptions quite precise. We used a this extended body theory, and then we got the answer, which looks something of this form, spin cross the force you are in, which comes exactly from this kinematical correction, which is like, you know, velocity cross the spin. So the summary of point one is the bobbing is ubiquitous. I think we've actually shown this, which is very nice. And the surprise is just because your intuition is used to the wrong thing, actually, the lab frame center of energy. So the questions for part two go back to Latham's question. Can there be other effects? What about frame dragging in the black hole case, for example? So those would be effects that make the bodies bob in a way that depends precisely on the nature of the interaction between the bodies, in contrast to this kinematical stuff. So we're going to call those dynamical bobbing. And so the question to ask is, can you get that? And also, what does this have to do with kicks? Okay, so dynamical bobbing, well, gravitational fields carry momentum, so there's nothing stopping them exchanging that momentum with the bodies and producing bobbing. But the trouble with gravity is you can't localize the field momentum. Only the total momentum in some giant asymptotically flat region is well defined. There's no stress energy tensor for the gravitational field. You can sort of mock up one with this pseudotensor approach, and the Caltech group here did that. But of course, your results for the local momentum are going to depend on things like what pseudotensor you chose and what gauge you chose. So, I mean, this group, they're more adopting the point of view that let's just pick a pseudotensor and pick a gauge and use it to develop intuition for how bodies are going to move, and that's fine. But for the purposes of this talk, I need to be able to localize field momentum. So the idea is, you know, maybe we can do it approximately in gravity or something, but we don't really know exactly how. Let's just work with some place where everything makes sense. So let's do electromagnetism where you can localize field momentum. We all know how to compute the stress energy tensor of a Maxwell field. So let's do an electromagnetic analog of a black hole binary, which is just let's have two bodies orbiting each other, and they'll be massive, they'll have spin, they'll have charge, and they'll have magnetic dipole, which is like the electromagnetic analog of spin. So we know this kinematical bobbing effect should be there. That's there for any system, regardless of the forces causing orbit. But is there any dynamical bobbing? So you can just do the calculation by brute force. In this self-force paper, and also in Abe Hart's other self-force paper, we derived the full equation of motion for a small body. It's got the Lorentz force. It's got the self-force. It's got, you know, electric dipole forces, magnetic dipole forces. We're not considering higher moments. And it's also got all this stuff, which was a big shock to us back then. But this one shouldn't surprise you too much. This is just that kinematical term that I was showing you in the billiard ball case. But anyway, there's also this other stuff. But for these slides, rather than trying to understand everything, I'm just going to do a brute force calculation. So we're going to make approximations that correspond to a kind of post-Coulomb expansion, analogous to the post-Newtonian expansion of general relativity. And that means the velocity goes like half a power of some small parameter, the mass and the charge are like one power, and the spin and the magnetic dipole are like two powers. And we'll set the electric dipole equal to zero, because that has no analog in gravity. You know, in gravity, you can't separate. You only have one charge. You don't have positive and negative, so you can't get a dipole. So anyway, you pretend one body is moving in the external field of the other, and you do a calculation with all this force law, and you get this big, long equation, and I can sort of tell you what each one is. This is just the Lorentz force. So body B makes an electromagnetic field, and body A feels a Lorentz force due to that. I'm keeping only the terms proportional to the spin and dipole, because in the end, only those can give bobbing. The second term is dipole forces. It's the, you know, body B is making a ordinary Coulomb field proportional to QB, but now we have the dipole of body A is feeling the interaction due to gradients in changing magnetic field from the velocity of the other body, and also due to time changes in the electric field through this funny force. And then finally, this is just rewriting the kinematical term in terms of the orbital parameters, which, by the way, are relative velocity. So R is the relative separation, and V is the relative velocity. So now to focus on bobbing, I'll dot this into the kind of instantaneous orbital plane, just the velocity and the separation vector span a plane. And doing this for body A, we can group the terms into what I would call dynamical bobbing and kinematical bobbing. So the dynamical bobbing is a kind of, it's like a frame dragging effect in gravity. It's just, you know, if you've got magnetic dipoles in here, you've broken the symmetry enough that you can have forces out of the plane. And this is what they are. So the body can go up and down, not only due to the spin kinematical effect, but also due to the electromagnetic interaction. But the remarkable thing is if we consider the net bobbing, if we say, I want to get rid of situations where the bodies just go like this, I want to think about the whole orbital plane, you know, stuff like this. So I want to consider the mass times the acceleration of one plus the mass times the acceleration of the other, a kind of center of mass for the two bodies. The remarkable thing is all the dynamical bobbing cancels out. You can see that just because, you know, we want to figure out what MBAB is to add it to MA, so we just interchange A and B, and this is even under the interchange, but these relative separation, R and V stuff, is all odd under the interchange, so this whole thing is odd, and it just cancels out. So what we're finding is that any time a electromagnetic force pushes a body upward, a corresponding force always pushes the other body downward. So you have a kind of preservation of Newton's third law for the electromagnetic forces. So there's a way to explain this, and it's called hidden mechanical momentum. And it could stand as an awesome topic independently of this talk. You can read about it in Griffiths. You can hear the words in Jackson. I wouldn't recommend trying to learn anything from them. But Griffiths really shows you what's going on. So let me introduce this. So statement that I'm sure everybody will find totally reasonable, the total momentum of the stationary system is zero. I'm going to prove it just because I'm going to say other things that might surprise you. So I want everything very careful. So anyway, we just start with conservation of stress energy. The stationarity assumption means this guy vanishes. So we just have the divergence of this momentum density is zero. Integrate both sides of that with respect to x. Multiply both sides by x, power of x, and integrate over space. You have this equals zero. Then we can integrate by parts. That just brings the derivative over here, which becomes a Kronecker delta, which means we have the total momentum. So this is a very simple proof that the total momentum of any stationary system is always zero. But now consider this stationary system. Let's have a constant electric field, and let's put a magnetic dipole in it. So it's stationary because it's not going to feel a force due to the electric field. It's a magnetic dipole, a couple of magnetic field. You can do a calculation and show that there's field momentum in this system. So if you just compute the pointing vector, E cross B, integrate it over all space, you will find that there is net electromagnetic field momentum in the system of minus mu cross E. Maybe field momentum's a little weird. It's surprising, but, I can get used to it. But then you realize that you had this theorem that the total momentum is zero. So that actually implies that in this dipole that's just sitting here, there's mechanical momentum, bona fide mechanical momentum, not field momentum, sitting in this dipole. And by this argument, it has to be mu cross E.
To what degree can you think of that as a natural thing that is actually there, and it's not just an artifact or something going away in the calculation or our understanding?
I think the next slide will convince you.
Okay.
So Griffiths has an example of how to understand how this mechanical momentum is stored, which is very, very wonderful. So the idea is you model the magnetic dipole as a current loop. This is stolen from Griffiths. He's got a rectangular current loop for convenience. And you've got an electric field. So what that means is the electric field is going to accelerate charges in this direction, and it's going to decelerate charges in that direction. So in order to conserve current, which is actually conserved, you have to have more charges down here going at a lower velocity than you have up here going at a higher velocity. So it rearranges the charge carriers in response to the electric field. I won't do the details because I don't want to take too long, but you just do the calculation, you figure out what all these things are, you compute, and you find, the momentum, if I called it MV, is zero. That's what your intuition would say. These should be rearranging such that the net momentum is still zero. But the momentum is not MV in relativity. The momentum is gamma MV. And gamma MV is not zero. And that's basically what's going on. You go through the calculation, you figure out, exactly what the formula for the mechanical momentum is. We haven't done any electromagnetism except for figuring out how it accelerated these charges, and you get exactly the mu cross E that I derived on the previous page. So to recap, the calculation is nice, but I think words are sufficient. So to recap, you've got a magnetic dipole in an electric field. What it does is it makes the velocity uneven of the charge carriers. The charge carriers then have to adjust their number density to satisfy conservation of current. Current is conserved. And that means they adjust it so that, MV is zero around, because the current is like MV or QV or whatever. But, of course, the momentum is not MV. This is relativity. We have to include the gamma. And when you include the gamma, there's no reason for net momentum to be zero. There's no conservation there. Then you find this answer. So this is another logical place to see if people want to ask anything, puzzle over these curious phenomena. Doesn't look like it. Okay, so now I'm going to claim that you can apply this to the electromagnetic binary to understand what's going on. So remember that equation I showed at the beginning, which was P equals MV, but there was this mysterious stuff. Well, now I'm going to tell you what that mysterious stuff is. It's hidden momentum, right? It is exactly the difference between P and what you thought it should be, MV, is going to be this mu cross E, hidden momentum. So I can just do this calculation in front of you. I think there's time. We're supposed to integrate the zero component of the Lorentz force density. So Lorentz force density is just this. The zero component is just F0 nu dotted into J. But of course, this is anti-symmetric, so we only have F0i dotted into Ji, the current, not the charge. So this is really just E dot J, the external electric field dotted into the current. So then we do the integral of that, plug in E dot J for F0. We're supposed to do the integral against X minus Z. And then the idea is, well, the electric field is approximately constant in this. I mean, this can be made precise, but in this 1.5 post-Coulombic approximation, we consider the E field of one body is approximately constant over the other body. It's just because there's a large separation. So you can pull E out of the integral, and then you just have the current integrated against a power of X, which is exactly the dipole moment of the current, which is exactly what's meant by the magnetic dipole. Here I've got it as a 2-index mu, which would be related to the usual 1 by an epsilon. So this means what you're crossing here is the external field E here with the magnetic dipole moment, so mu cross E. So the mechanical momentum of a body in the slow motion limit is given by mv, except this lab frame, remember that, plus this hidden momentum. So now we can also ask about the momentum in the electromagnetic field. Well, you won't be surprised to know that it's exactly the same thing as happened in the stationary case. Remember, in the stationary case, we had equal and opposite momentum in the electromagnetic field and in the bodies in the form of hidden momentum. So I think I won't go through this calculation, but you can just do a very quick calculation of the field energy. Well, I suppose I should point out up here that I'm sweeping a lot of work under the rug. We worked very hard in our previous papers to show that the self-field of a body really just renormalizes the mass density of the body or its stress energy moment. So you know, you should regard the electromagnetic self-energy of a body as contributing a little bit to its mass, and you can kind of forget about it. I don't have time to go into that, but the claim is that when we're worried about field momentum, we only have to consider this kind of cross-term portion where you're multiplying the electromagnetic field of one guy by the electromagnetic field of the other guy. The self-field stuff is really already contained in stuff like this T0i. I really meant this is the mechanical stress energy plus the self-field electromagnetic stress energy. That's a subtlety I should point out, just so it doesn't appear all totally magical, but it can be handled. So with that aside, we just want to compute E of one field cross B of the other, and vice versa, and you can do a simple calculation that shows it's exactly minus mu cross E, just like in the stationary case. So the momentum budget for this electromagnetic binary system is as follows. In the bodies, you have mv, and you also have the hidden momentum. In the electromagnetic field, you have minus what the hidden momentum was. You have a cancellation, just like in that stationary example. So the total momentum perpendicular to the orbit here is just the mv stuff. So this is explaining the kind of Newton's third law thing. The way you can violate Newton's third law is to have momentum to exchange with the bodies. But here, whenever you exchange that momentum, it's always going into hidden momentum. The field momentum and the hidden momentum always exactly cancel. And so it's telling you that for electromagnetic forces, you still have to have Newton's third law. You can't have electromagnetic field momentum changing the way your center of mass moves. I think I can explain that more clearly in the next slide. I just need to point out that, of course, I've been leaving these as lab frame, but in reality, this kinematical effect is always there. We're always interested in the real center of mass, not the lab frame center of energy, so you have to apply this V cross S correction, which at the level of momentum is just a derivative of the position shift, so a derivative of V cross S is an A cross S, and so the total momentum is mv of 1 plus mv of 2 plus this weird kinematical piece, and the conservation of this combined with the statement that A changes as you go around the orbit is the same kinematical bobbing effect. V has to change to correspond. So the final curious picture of what's going on is that in this electromagnetic analog, the bodies are orbiting each other, and they are exchanging momentum. The field momentum is oscillating. It's mu cross E, and mu is staying fixed while E changes direction during the orbit. You're getting a sinusoidal oscillation of the momentum in the field and a corresponding oscillation of the momentum in the bodies. But whenever the field momentum goes into the bodies, it always goes as hidden momentum. So it can't move the center of mass of the body. I like to imagine, you know, I'm at the gas pump and I have the body here. I've got my, and when I'm pumping into it with my pump is momentum. I'm changing field momentum and I'm putting it in the body and I think the body's going to go flying off because I gave it momentum. You know, but the body says, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to rearrange my charge carriers in such a way so that I have the mechanical momentum and I don't have to go anywhere. So that's sort of what's happening here. Try as the momentum exchange might to get there to be bobbing. It can't because of hidden momentum. So there's no bobbing proportional to the electromagnetic field. There's just this kinematical effect, which I've now rewritten in a more suggestive form, where it looks just like the result I showed for the tether balls, where you have spin cross the force here. It's just the Coulomb force that's keeping the bodies in orbit. So I think,
is that something that you expect to continue to hold higher and higher orders? I mean, do you understand the sort of general terms?
I don't know. That's a great question. I'm really only technically accounting for what goes on in the slow motion limit. As the bodies move towards each other, you need higher terms. I would expect there'd be some small bobbing, dynamical bobbing. I don't know why the hidden momentum would continue to prevent it. But it is preventing the dominant effect.
But your argument is that with the hidden momentum, they would stay. So there would be still hidden momentum to one order. So it's because
yeah, this is the lowest order. Yeah, this is just the lowest order piece. All right, well, so let me see if anyone else wants to puzzle over these strange and mysterious claims. Okay. All right, so now the question is, what can we do for gravity? Well, you all know that there is a close correspondence, certainly at the level of the Coulomb force. Newton and Coulomb both have inverse square laws. But to what extent can we go beyond that and try to transform these very precise results in electromagnetism to something that has something to do with black holes in gravity? Well, so we took this analogy, and some people had extended it to some terms with spin and dipole. We went nuts. We did all the spin-dipole terms. We even did the quadrupole terms. And we showed that basically if you start with the equation of motion for a small body in electromagnetism, and you want to figure out how an analogous body would move in an external gravitational field, by which I mean pretend space-time is flat, treat the gravitational field as metric perturbation, and figure out how the body moves relative to what it would in flat space-time. So if you want to do that, the recipe is pretty simple, at least in general. First of all, you take all those terms, any terms proportional to the spin, which are kinematical, and you leave them alone. You don't want to change those at all. Those have to be identical. That's the nature of this kinematical effect. But then for the rest of the terms, you just do basic stuff, like you change the charge to the mass because, Coulomb force is analogous to Newton's force. And, of course, the magnetic dipole goes to the spin. That's the analog there. And while it's a factor of 1 for these electric effects, it's actually a factor of 4 for magnetic effects. I don't think there's a deep reason. That's just the analogy. But there are these gravitomagnetic effects that correspond to a factor of 4 times what's going on in electromagnetism.
Yeah. About the previous slide, what mu is the dipole moment in the frame of the rest frame?
Yeah, it's all defined relative to the rest frame. Yeah. In fact, at this level of approximation, because mu is already quite small, the difference doesn't make a difference. But yes, everything has to be. In fact, in my abstract, I didn't put this in talk. In my abstract, I mentioned Thomas precession. Thomas precession is if you define a spin in not relative to the rest frame. If you define it relative to the lab frame, you get the wrong answer. And the difference is kind of an anomalous precession, and that's exactly what Thomas precession is. So these issues have come up, but not in this context yet. Okay, so yeah, I just thought I'd show you, the full story in this case, since I've been hiding various scary pieces of the analysis for this talk and such. So these are the precise rules we came up with. So the first term is basically, don't mess with the kinematical stuff. You have to leave that as is. That should be the same for all forces. So just take the electric force QE and change it to the analogous gravitational force. There's a minus sign for the change in sign of the interaction, and then leave it as is. And for the other terms, you do the usual stuff. Q goes to M, U goes to S. And then remember this factor of 4, well, we found that it was more convenient to organize that as saying that the gravitomagnetic field is 2 times stronger than the magnetic field, so that velocities in producing, velocity effects in producing gravitational fields are sort of twice as strong. And then also we would send the velocity to twice the velocity, and that's sort of saying that gravitational effects responding to magnetic gravitomagnetic fields are twice as strong as well. That's just a nicer way of organizing it. And then there's quadruple moments for the for electromagnetism and gravity. Well, for mass and for current, so this is mass and this is current. Anyway, you send everything to what it is, and you have to multiply by minus one again for that change in the sign of the interaction. And then step three is, oops, well, it all worked wonderfully at first order in V, but at second order in V, it all almost works. There's like five terms that match, and you have to add this term in if you want it to work. What we're doing is all actually at first order in V, so that weirdness doesn't come up. But this does allow us to derive the analogous gravitational equation. So you can take our electromagnetic result, and you can apply these substitution rules, and you can find out what the analogous 1.5 post-Newtonian result would be. And to do it properly, you really need to write this back in terms of electric field and follow the rules changing it to gravitoelectric field. But for this slide, I'll just show you that this is staying the same. Well, the front here is having a factor of 2 due to velocities, and the q mu is changing to ms. And so the dynamical terms, we would still call these dynamical, but now they're controlled by s, not mu, because this is gravity. S controls both kinematical effects and dynamical effects in gravity. So one of the points that I like to make is that the Caltech group did this, derived these equations directly. They do agree. But they didn't pay much attention to the interpretation here, which I think is a real interpretation, and it's made especially manifest by this analogy. These terms, which are proportional to spin, should be it should be thought of as due to the gravitational interaction, whereas these terms that are proportional to spin are just the same old kinematic effect that causes, causes billiard balls to bob. So you can just rewrite the final result, again, in this form that makes it all look the same, and I'll just skip to the next slide. So the summary of parts 1 through 3, and part 4 will be very short, is that net bobbing is kinematical in all of these systems. So in tether balls, there's a tether force, which has an interaction which looks like S cross F. In 1.5 post-Coulombic electromagnetism, there's a Coulomb force, which makes this bobbing in a form S cross F. And in 1.5 post-Newtonian gravity, there's a Newton force, which makes this bobbing happen with an S cross F form, where F in each case is just the force holding it in orbit. So this is the kinematical nature of the bobbing effect, and the dynamical bobbing effects in the electromagnetic case canceled out due to hidden momentum, and I would be tempted to say the same thing in gravity. Certainly the result is true, but the interpretation in terms of momentum, well, you get into trouble with gravitational momentum.
Well, so let me just ask you, so when you jump from the electromagnetism to the gravitational case, there are obvious things that don't have, that don't appear in the gravitational case that do, that did let you do this analysis about the hidden momentum, where you use explicitly the Kapitsky dipole magnetic field was not
right.
The electric field. So can you not be losing something by just saying, okay, this is how it's going to go?
Well, I mean, when you change mu to S and also S to S, you lose information because they're both mapped. So I'm not sure if you're asking more from the previous slide. What right do I have to say this is dynamical and this is kinematical because they're all spin? Is that sort of the question? Or
well, I was going more towards when you said, okay, the dynamical goes away in the electromagnetic case.
Yeah.
You argue it's due to this hidden momentum.
Yeah.
Momentum, which you then have an argument for based on the fact that the magnetic dipole
right.
field, the influence of the
yeah.
electric field, that doesn't happen in the gravity.
Yeah.
Yet you still are saying, okay, the same is going to go.
Well, I'm saying it's a nice way to think about it. I can't even define gravitational field momentum, so I can't really do it. But I suspect that in the post-Newtonian limit, there's some sense in which there's a hidden momentum story, like in gravitational, but you might have to use the pseudo-tensor stuff. I mean,
well, I guess what I'm asking is so the dynamical P's need not cancel gravitation, so you're taking a leap of faith.
I don't think there are P's in gravity. I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Right, but see, if you were to think that there is such a...
Yeah, I would think they would cancel in the same way, just because the analogy is so strong. The point of the talk is you can't say anything definitive about gravity, but you can say stuff definitive about systems that behave very similarly. So in terms of understanding what's going on, it makes sense to think about the analogous systems and say definitive things, and then if that helps you understand gravity, great. If not, then I guess you're stuck where you used to be. But you're never going to do better because you can't define gravitational field momentum. Okay, so finally, I think the bobbing, especially in the kinematical case, is a very nice closed story. You know, the dynamical bobbing of movies was probing is a little less clear. Still very nice, and the least clear is what this has to do with kicks, because kicks must be accompanied by radiation and momentum off to infinity. You can make sense of total momentum in a big gravitational system, and it's conserved, so if a body is going to be moving at the end, you have to have momentum leaving the system in the other direction. So kicks require radiation and field momentum. One point before diving into this is you can immediately say that in general, bobbing and kicks are not the same thing. That, you know, the tether ball system would bob up and down, bob up and down, bob up and down, but there's no momentum to be radiated there. The only interaction is the tether. So you'd never get a kick when these, sorry, I haven't used the term tether balls, when these billiard balls, you know, bob up and down and combine, you'd never get a kick. The electromagnetic binary, on the other hand, could certainly have a kick, but unfortunately this 1.5 post-Coulomb approximation can't get it because it's quasi-static, and in particular it doesn't have radiation. So we can't just compute the radiation. If we did, it probably wouldn't be very accurate anyway. But what we can say, I think, is quite powerful, which is that in the electromagnetic problem, the momentum radiated during the merger is probably related to the configuration of field momentum just before merger in some way. I'm not going to name a precise way. I wouldn't know what to say. But it should be related in some way. You know, you can imagine that, you know, the black holes, or in this case, the electromagnetic charges, you know, it's all slow motion, quasi-static. Everything has time to equilibrate. But then near merger, they just fly together, and there's no time for the field momentum to equilibrate, and it gets released. So that's a vague picture of the kick. It's not going to produce quantitative predictions, but it can tell us some interesting qualitative stuff, which is that you should be able to tune the kick in the electromagnetic case, right? The bobbing will go up and down. That's kinematical. You can tune that with spin. But the kick should be dependent on the magnetic dipole moment. For example, if you set it to zero, you'll get no kick. For sure, I can say that, because there's not going to be field momentum around if you set the magnetic dipole to zero. So it's a very vivid illustration that you should be able to have exactly the same bobbing motion, but no kick at all, even in the electromagnetic case, or you should be able to make it go in the opposite direction it used to go just by changing the magnetic dipole to the opposite sign, and stuff like that. So what about gravity? Finally, here's that quirk of the gravitational system I mentioned earlier, which is supposed to explain why in gravity it looks like the kick is an inertial continuation of the bobbing. Well, in the gravitational analogy, the spin, the magnetic dipole is mapped to the spin, but the spin is also mapped to the spin. So in gravity, spin is controlling both the kinematical effects and the dynamical effects. And in fact, it's the same sort of functional form, too. Both are this, you know, A cross S type thing. So both of these effects are controlled by spin, so that is some kind of explanation as to why they would appear related, even though, arguing by analogy, they have nothing to do with each other. Oh, I heard something. Okay, so that's it. I've clocked in at under an hour easily. So the summary of the findings is we did this tetherball system, which I changed to billiard balls for today, and we did the electromagnetic binary, and we did the gravitational binary using the analogy we derived to derive those equations. In all cases, the net bobbing was kinematical, but the kick, there'd certainly be no kick in the case of billiard balls. We should be able to tune it independently of the bobbing in case of electromagnetism, and in gravity, by those arguments, it should be tied to the bobbing as is found in these numerical simulations. So this is what we found, and then to summarize, to try to make a clean split between finding and interpretation, well, at least for the bobbing, and I'd say probably also for the kick, there's no weird black hole physics, no strange general relativity. This frame-dragging effect might have been there in the slow-motion limit, but it was, you know, it all canceled out. There was no dynamical bobbing, just the usual kinematical stuff. So basically, you can understand this just with this simple freshman physics intuition. You don't need GR or black holes, but you have to make this slight adjustment that the, you know, lab frame center of energy is really the thing your intuition, unfortunately, is geared up to imagining. And then finally, just as a punchline to take home, the claim is the bobbing is kinematical, and the kick is unrelated. So thank you for your attention.
So I don't quite remember what configurations actually lead to mobbing. And yet, I think that there might be a way to tease out the schematic of mobbing away from the frame dragging explanation that's often attributed to it. Does the mobbing actually occur? Well, not mobbing, but there should be a shifting in the center of mass. If you had a configuration that was, I don't know, something like this, right? There should be.
Well, if you did this, then your V cross S, let's see. So this is the spin vector?
Yes, the spin vector.
And they're orbiting like this? So V is this way. So let's see.
And overall, I think that the effector is always pointing in the same direction.
Is it always?
Yeah, that sounds
right.
Well, he's putting it vertically, and so he doesn't have V cross S equals zero.
Right.
So there is this result that if you align it vertically versus this way, that the sort of the given frequency, the radius separation is different.
Well,
I mean, you know that the just that there is this, there's what do they call it, the
spin orbit or precession,
whatever. This thing that if you set up the black holes like this, they take longer to merge.
Because the final spin
has to be a
higher, and so then you're able to probe a much higher final black hole has a higher spin, and then the ISCO closes in, and then you are able to go to higher and higher frequencies. But you got to consider this case and that case, and they're sufficiently separated. They don't notice the difference. So just one would merge faster, earlier than the other one.
I think in the post-Newtonian limit, there's a repulsive force.
If I put them sufficiently far, that term goes zero.
I think his effect is predicted by these equations. I mean, yeah, you were saying that.
You're probably right, it goes to zero, but I think you're probably.
It looks like you can't get anything if it's like that or it's like that.
It just wouldn't bob, but it would be an extra force,
right,
it sounds
right.
Like.
But if it were like that, I imagine it would be the center of mass would be moving left or right.
Center of mass? No, I don't.
No, because it always points radially. That's what. So his force, right. If you take V cross S, it'll always point radially inward as you go around. And you take the opposite direction, it'll always point radially outward. So it's an overall, it's this extra attraction or extra repulsion between them.
Yeah, seems right.
But I thought kinematic bobbing meant that it was essentially the distinction between the center of
mass and
center of energy.
Yeah,
so
it's just,
if there's a net. If they don't cancel out, if the V cross S is from both, they'll cancel out.
No, but I think you're looking for the other case.
Yeah, but you're comparing.
It's this case, the one you're looking, because V cross S in that way
will
be zero. So the kinematical term is not there. But these things, there will still be frame dragging on this other one. Right? So it can affect. I can have this term go zero, but then.
No, what I'm trying to look at is something that does not have the frame dragging.
But not strongly anyway.
You're saying that they're both essentially V cross S. And you can't tease out one effect from
no, but this term, you can always make the zero by having the right cross term there. But the frame dragging, you cannot make it. You cannot set a zero because it's there.
So
you have an easier time letting the frame dragging be there and nothing else.
It's funny. Kip's paper says something like there's 8 A cross S worth of frame dragging and minus 7 A cross S worth of spin orbit coupling or spin curvature coupling or something. So we're saying there's 7 and minus 7 and the remaining one is kinematical. I think it's right. I mean, they just cancel, actually, these two effects. And that's exactly the Newton's third law. It's the same thing in electromagnetism. You have the ordinary dipole force and then this strange term, which is actually related to hidden momentum. So if you do the calculation, you think about the ordinary dipole force, you think, oh yeah, there's going to be bobbing, but there's always this other force making the other body go down. So they just do this. I think it's the same in gravity with frame dragging and spin curvature coupling.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
I'm trying to think of the case where the spin vanishes. So, and in this picture there's no bobbing and stuff.
Yeah.
But if you take the unequal mass binaries and stuff, you still have kicks and so I'm trying to,
yeah, well,
to
that's
get a little...
The kick in the unequal mass case is tip. I mean, there's this Wiseman picture where you've got asymmetry, so you're radiating more direct momentum in this direction.
And
less.
That's the reason why it's just...
And,
but
that's
the
a very...
Thing,
I think these are quite possibly qualitatively different effects. I mean, at some level, a kick is radiation field momentum, so it's all qualitatively the same. But I have in mind, if this picture is right, that the super kick is the result from some very non-adiabatic thing where suddenly the bodies merge and so the momentum flies off, whereas the unequal mass kicks is more of a just slow buildup of radiated, you know, asymmetric radiated. You might be able to test this with certain numerical simulations. I don't know. But like Pretorius always tries to think of the superkick as also that picture where you're sort of beaming off an enormous amount of radiation up when you're on the up bob, and then beaming off an enormous amount of radiation down when you're on the down bob, and then fly off. So I think that may not be the right way to think about it. But that's sort of neither here nor there until more analysis can be done.
Okay, so we'll thank Sam again and just leave the room for the next one. All right.